Even after he'd slain a fair number of them, Saul Tarvitz was still unable to say where the biology of the Megarachnid stopped and their technology began. They were the most perfect fusion of artifice and organism. They did not wear their armour or carry their weapons. Their armour was an integument bonded to their arthropod shells, and they possessed weapons as naturally as a man might own fingers or a mouth. Tarvitz loathed them, and loved them too. He loathed them for their abominable want of human perfection. He loved them because they were genuinely testing foes, and in mastering them, the Emperor's children would take another stride closer to attaining their full potential. "We always need a rival," his Lord Eidolon had once said, "a true rival of considerable strength and fortitude. Only against such a rival can our prowess be properly measured." There was more at stake here than the Legion's prowess, and Tarvitz understood that solemnly. Brother Astartes were in trouble, and this was a mission, though no one had dared actually use the term of rescue. It was thoroughly improper to openly suggest that the Blood Angels needed rescuing. Reinforcement, that was the word they'd been told to use, but it was hard to reinforce what you could not find. They had been on the surface of murder for 66 hours and had found no sign of the 140th Expedition Forces, or even, for the most part, of each other. Lord Commander Eidolon had committed the entire company to the surface drop. The descent had been worse than the warnings they'd been given prior to the drop, and the warnings had been grim enough. Nightmarish atmospherics had scattered their drop pods like chaff, casting them wildly astray from their projected landing vectors. Tarvitz knew it was likely many pods hadn't even made it to the ground intact. He found himself one of two captains in charge of just over 30 men, around 1/3 of the company force, and all that had been able to regroup after planetfall. Due to the storm cover, they couldn't raise the fleet in orbit, nor could they raise Eidolon or any other part of the landing force. Presuming Eidolon and any other part of the landing force had survived. The whole situation smacked of abject failure, and failure was not a concept the Emperor's children cared to entertain. To turn failure into something else, there was little choice but to get on with the remit of the undertaking. So they spread out in a search pattern to find the brothers they had come to help. On the way, perhaps they might reunite with other elements of their scattered force, or even find some geographical frame of reference. The drop site environs were disconcerting. Under an enamel-white sky, fizzling and blemished by the megarachnid shield storms, the land was an undulating plain of ferrous red dust from which a sea of gigantic grass stalks grew, grey-white like dirty ice. Each stalk, as thick as a man's plated thigh, rose up straight to a height of 20 meters, tough, dry, and bristly. They swished gently in the radioactive wind, but such was their size at ground level. The air was filled with the creaking, moaning sound of their structures in motion. The Astartes moved through the groaning forest of stalks like lice in a wheat field. The bases of most of the grass stalks were thick with swollen black larvae, sack things the size of a man's head, clustered tumorously to the meter or so of a stalk closest to the ground. The larvae did nothing but cling and presumably drink. As they did so, they made a weird, hissing, whistling noise that added to the eerie acoustics. Bull had suggested that the larvae might be infant forms of the enemy, and for the first few hours they had systematically destroyed all they found, but the work was wearying and unending. There were larvae everywhere, and eventually they had chosen to forget it and ignore the hissing sacks. Besides, the fetid ichor that burst from the larvae when they were struck was damaging the edges of their weapons and scarring their armour where it splashed. Lucius, Tarvitz's fellow captain, had found the first tree and called them all close to inspect it. It was a curious thing, apparently made of a calcified white stone, and it dwarfed the surrounding sea of stalks. It was shaped like a wide-capped mushroom, a 50-metre dome supported on a thick, squat trunk 10 metres broad. The dome was an intricate hemisphere of sharp, bone-white thorns, tangled and sharply pointed, the barbs some 2 or 3 metres in length. "What is it for?" Tarvitz wondered. "It's a tree. It has no purpose," Lucius replied. In that, Lucius was wrong. Lucius was younger than Tarvitz, though they were both old enough to have seen many wonders in their lives. They were friends, except that the balance of their friendship was steeply and invisibly weighted in one direction. Saul and Lucius represented the bipolar aspect of their legion. Like all of the Emperor's children, they devoted themselves to the pursuit of martial perfection, but Saul was diligently grounded, where Lucius was ambitious. Saul Tarvitz had long since realized that Lucius would one day outstrip him in honor and rank. Lucius would perhaps become a Lord Commander in due course, part of the aloof inner circle at the Legion's traditionally hierarchical core. Tarvitz didn't care. He was a file officer and had no desire for elevation. He was content to glorify the Primarch and the Emperor with unstinting devotion. Lucius mocked him playfully sometimes, claiming Tarvitz courted the common ranks because he couldn't win the respect of the officers. Tarvitz always laughed that off because he knew Lucius didn't understand. Saul Tarvitz followed the code exactly and took pride in that. He knew his perfect destiny was as a file officer. To crave more would have been imperfect. Tarvitz had standards and despised anyone who cast their own standards aside in the hunt for inappropriate goals. It was all about purity, not superiority. That's what the other legions always failed to understand. Barely 15 minutes after the discovery of the tree, the first of many they would find scattered throughout the creaking grasslands, they had their first dealings with a megarachnid. The enemy's arrival had been announced by 3 signs. The larvae nearby had suddenly stopped hissing. The towering grass stalks had begun an abrupt, shivering vibration, as if electrified. Then the Astartes had heard a strange, chittering noise coming closer. Tarvitz barely saw the enemy warriors during the first clash. They had come out of the grass forest, moving so fast they were silver blurs. The fight lasted 12 chaotic seconds, a period filled to capacity with gunshots and shouts. Then the enemy had vanished again, as fast as they had come. The stalks had stilled, and the larvae had resumed their hissing. "Did you see them?" asked Kirkort, reloading his bolter. "I saw something," Tarvis admitted, doing the same. "Durellan's dead. So is Martius," Lucius announced casually, approaching them with something in his hand. Tarvis couldn't quite believe what he had been told. "They're dead?" he asked Lucius. "The fight surely hadn't lasted long enough to have included the passing of 2 veteran Astartes." "Dead," nodded Lucius. "You can look upon their cadavers if you wish. They're over there. They were too slow." Weapon raised, Tarvitz pushed through the swaying stalks, some of them broken and snapped over by frantic bolter fire. He saw the 2 bodies tangled amid fallen white shoots on the red earth, their beautiful purple and gold armour sawn apart and running with blood. Dismayed, he looked away from the butchery. "Find Varus," he told Kirkort. And the man went off to locate the apothecary.
"Did we kill anything?" Bull asked.
"I hit something," Lucius said proudly, "but I cannot find the body. It left this behind."
He held out the thing in his hand. It was a limb, long, slender, hard. The main part of it, 1 meter long, was a gently curved blade, apparently made of brushed zinc or galvanized iron. It came to an astonishingly sharp point.
"Is it an arm?" Bull asked.
"It's a sword," Katz corrected.
"A sword with a joint," Bull snorted, "and meat inside."
Lucius grasped the limb just above the joint and brandished it like a sabre. He swung it at the nearest stalk, and it went clean through. With a lingering crash, the massive shoot toppled over, tearing into others as it fell. Lucius started laughing. Then he cried out in pain and dropped the limb. Even the base part of the limb above the joint had an edge, and it was so sharp that the force of his grip had bitten through his gauntlet.
"It has cut me,"
Lucius complained, poking at his ruptured glove. Tarvitz looked down at the limb, bent and still on the red soil.
"Little wonder they can slice us to ribbons."
1/2 hour later, when the stalk shivered again, Tarvitz met his first megarachnid face to face. He killed it, but it was a close-run thing, over in 2 seconds. From that encounter, Saul Tarvitz began to understand why Kittus Frome had named the world Murder. The great warship returned to the silent, physical cosmos of real space again, with a shivering impact.
It had translated 12 weeks earlier, by the shipboard clocks, and had made a journey that ought to have taken 18 weeks. Great powers had been put into play to expedite the transit, powers that only a war master could call upon. It coasted for about 6 million kilometres, trailing the last luminous tendrils of plasmic flare from its immense bulk until strobing flashes of unlight to stern announced the belated arrival of its consorts, 10 light cruisers and 5 mass-conveyance troopships. As they approached, the flagship ignited its own drives and led them in. Towards 140-20, towards murder. Forward array detectors pinged as they tasted the magnetic and energetic profiles of other ships at high anchor around the system's fourth planet, 80 million kilometres ahead. The local sun was yellow and hot and billowed with loud, charged particles. Seated in a high back chair that had been drawn up close to the window ports of his sanctum to afford a better view of the starfield outside, the War Master took a deep, steady breath, then rose to his feet. He was dressed in full ceremonial war gear, gleaming gold and white, with a vast mantle of purple scale skin draped across his shoulders. He turned to face the 10 Astartes officers gathered in the centre of the room, before leading them out of the sanctum into the strategium deck. The 4 captains of the Morneville and the company commanders, Zedaray of the 13th, Cruz of the 3rd, Targost of the 7th, Ma of the 18th, Moy of the 19th, and Goshen of the 25th. "Let's have tactical," the War Master said. Malagurst was waiting, ready. As he motioned with his control wand, hololithic images shimmered into place above the dais. They showed a general profile of the system, with orbital paths delineated and the position and motion of tracked vessels. Horus gazed up at the graphics and reached out. Actuator sensors built into the fingertips of his gauntlets allowed him to rotate the display and bring certain segments into magnification. 29 craft, he said. I thought the 140th was 18 vessels strong.
Don't worry, they're ours, Loken said.
The War Master looked over at him.
You think so, Gaviel?
Seems evident to me, sir. The hits show a spread of ships at high anchor, Imperial anchorage formation. Others must have responded to the call for assistance.
Loken trailed off and suddenly fought back an embarrassed smile.
But you knew that all along, of course, my lord.
I was just wondering who else might have been sharp enough to recognize the pattern.
Horace smiled. The War Master nodded towards the display.
So what's this big fellow here? That's a barge.
The Misery Court, suggested Cruz.
No, no. That's the Misery Court. And what's this about?
Horace leaned forwards and ran his fingers across the hard light display.
It looks like music. Who's transmitting music?
Outstation relays, Abdon said, studying his own data slate. Beacons. The 140th reported 30 beacons in the system grid. The Xenos. Their broadcasts are repeating and untranslatable.
Really? They have no ships, but they have outstation beacons?
Horus reached out and changed the display to a close breakdown of scatter patterns.
This is untranslatable.
So the 140th said Abaddon.
Have we taken their word for that?
Asked the War Master. I imagine we have, said Abaddon.
There's sense in this,
Horus decided, peering at the luminous graphics.
I want us to run this. Start with standard numeric blocks. With respect to the 140th, I don't intend to take their word for anything. Cursed awful job they've done here so far.
It is confirmed. All contacts are Imperial, Malagurst said, holding out a wafer slip of printout. Other units have been arriving these last few weeks in response to the calls for aid. Most of them are Imperial Army conveyances en route to Carolus Star, but the big vessel is the Proudheart. 3rd Legion, the Emperor's Children, a full company under the command privilege of Lord Commander Eidolon.
So they beat us to it. How are they doing?
Malaga shrugged.
Not well, he said.
The planet's official designation in the Imperial Registry was 140-20, it being the 20th world subjected to compliance by the fleet of the 140th expedition. But that was inaccurate, as clearly the 140th had not achieved anything like compliance. Still, the Emperor's children had used the number to begin with, for to do otherwise would have been an insult to the honour of the Blood Angels. Prior to arrival, Lord Commander Eidolon had briefed his Astartes comprehensively. The initial transmissions of the 140th Expedition had been clear and succinct. Kittus Frome, captain of the three Blood Angels companies that formed the marrow of the 140th, had reported Xenos hostilities a few days after his forces had touched down on the world's surface. He had described very capable things, like upright beetles, but made of or shod in metal. Each one is twice the height of a man and very belligerent. Assistance may be required if their numbers increase. After that, his relayed communiques had been somewhat patchy and intermittent. Fighting had grown thicker and more savage, and the Xenos forms appeared not to lack in numbers. A week later, and his transmissions were more urgent, "There is a race here that resists us and which we cannot easily overcome. They refuse to admit communication with us or any parley. They spill from their lairs. I find myself admiring their mettle, though they are not made as we are. Their martial schooling is fine indeed, a worthy foe, one that might be written about in our annals." A week after that, the expedition's messages had become rather more simple, sent by the master of the fleet instead of Frome. "The enemy here is formidable and quite outweighs us. To take this world, the full force of the Legio is required. We humbly submit a request for reinforcement at this time." Frome's last message, relayed from the surface a fortnight later by the expedition fleet, had been a tinny rasp of generally indecipherable noise. The only cogent thing that had come through was his final utterance. "This world is murder." And so they had named it. The task force of the Emperor's children was comparatively small in size, just a company of the Legion's main strength, conveyed by the battle barge Proudheart under the command of Lord Eidolon. After a brief peacekeeping tour of newly compliant worlds in the satyr Lanxus belt, they had been en route to rejoin their Primarch and brethren companies at Corollis Star to begin a mass advance into the lesser Bifold cluster. However, during their transit, the 140th Expedition had begun its request for assistance. The task force had been the closest Imperial unit fit to respond. Lord Eidolon had requested immediate permission for his Primarch to alter course and go to the Expedition's aid. Fulgrim had given his authority at once. The Emperor's children would never leave their Astartes brothers in jeopardy. Eidolon had been given his Primarch's blessing to reroute and support the beleaguered expedition. Other forces were rushing to assist. It was said a detachment of Blood Angels was on its way, as was a heavyweight response from the War Master himself, dispatched from the 63rd Expedition. At best, the closest of them was still many days off. Lord Eidolon's task force was the interim measure, critical response, the first to the scene. Eidolon's battle barge had joined with the operational vessels of the 140th Expedition at high anchor above 140-20. The 140th Expedition was a small, compact force of 18 carriers, mass conveyances and escorts supporting the noble battle barge Misericord. Its martial composition was three companies of Blood Angels under Captain Frome and 4,000 men of the Imperial Army with allied armour, but no Mechanicum force. Mathaniel August, master of the 140th Fleet, had welcomed Eidolon and his commanders aboard the barge. Tall and slender, with a forked white beard, August was fretful and nervous. "I am gratified at your quick response, Lord," he told Eidolon. "Where is Frome?" Eidolon had asked bluntly. August had shrugged helplessly. "Where is the commander of the army divisions?" A second pitiful shrug. "They are all down there." Down there, on murder. 50 Blood Angels had dropped first, inlanders, and had simply disappeared. Previously calm weather cycles had mutated into violent tempests the moment the landers had entered the atmosphere and swallowed them up. Due to the suddenly volatile climate, communication with the surface was impossible. Another 50 had followed and had similarly vanished. That was when Frome and the fleet officers had begun to suspect that the lifeforms of 14020 somehow commanded their own weather systems as a defence. The immense storm fronts, later dubbed shield storms, that had risen up to meet the surface-bound landers had probably obliterated them. After that, Frome had used drop pods, the only vehicles that seemed to survive the descent. Frome had led the third wave himself, and only partial messages had been received from him subsequently, even though he'd taken an astrotelepath with him to counter the climatic vox interference. It was a grim story. Section by section, August had committed the Astartes and army forces in his expedition to surface drops in a vain attempt to respond to Frome's broken pleas for support. They had either been destroyed by the storms or lost in the impenetrable maelstrom below. "We'll be going in blind," Eidolon had told his officers. "Drop pod descent."
"Perhaps you should wait, Lord," August had suggested. "We have word that a Blood Angel's force is en route to relieve Captain Frome, and the Lunar Wolves are but 4 days away. Combined, perhaps you might better."
That had decided it. Tarvitz knew Lord Eidolon had no intention of sharing any glory with the War Master's elite. He sanctioned the drop immediately. The Megarachnid warriors were 3 meters tall and possessed 8 limbs. They ambulated with dazzling speed on their 4 hindmost limbs and used the other 4 as weapons. Their bodies were segmented like an insect's. A small, compact abdomen hung between the 4 widespread, slender walking limbs. A massive, armoured thorax from which all 8 limbs depended, and a squat, wide, wedge-shaped head equipped with short, rattling mouthparts that issued the characteristic chittering noise, a heavy comb of brow armour, and no discernible eyes. The 4 upper limbs matched the trophy Lucius had taken in the first round, metal-cased blades over 1 meter in length beyond the joint. Every part of the Megarachnid appeared to be thickly plated with mottled, almost fibrous grey armour, except the head crests, which seemed to be natural, chitinous growths, rough, bony, and ivory. As the fighting wore on, Tarvitz thought he identified a status in those crests. The fuller the chitin growths, the more senior and larger the warrior. Tarvitz made his first kill with his bolter. The Megarachnid lunged out of the suddenly vibrating stalks in front of them and decapitated Kerkort with a flick of its upper left blade. Tarvitz had opened fire, denting the center line of the Megarachnid's thorax armor with 3 shots before his 4th obliterated the thing's head. Its legs stumbled and scrabbled, its blade arms waved, and then it fell. But just before it did, there was another crash. The crash was the sound of Kerkort's headless body finally hitting the red dust, arterial spray jetting from his severed neck. That was how fast the encounter had passed. From first strike to clean kill, poor Kerkort only had time to fall down. A second Megarachnid appeared behind the first. Its flickering limbs had torn Tarvitz's bolter out of his hands and set a deep gouge across the facing of his breastplate, right across the Imperial Aquila displayed there. That was a great crime. Alone amongst the legions, only the Emperor's children had been permitted by the grace of the Emperor himself to wear the Aquila on their chest plates. Backing away, hearing bolter fire and yells from the shivering thickets all around him, Tarvitz had felt stung by genuine insult and had unslung his broadsword, powered it, and struck downwards with a 2-handed cut. His long, heavy blade had glanced off the alien's headcrest, chipping off flecks of yellowish bone, and Tarvitz had been forced to dance back out of the reach of the 4 slicing limb blades. His second strike had been better. His sword missed the bone crest and instead hacked deeply into the Megarachnid's neck. He had split the thorax wide open to the centre, squirting out a gush of glistening white ichor. The Megarachnid had trembled, slowly understanding its own death as Tarvitz wrenched his blade back out. It took a moment to die. It reached out with its quivering blade limbs and touched the tips of them against Tarvitz's recoiling face, 2 on either side of the visor. The touch was almost gentle. As it fell, the 4 points made a shrieking sound as they dragged backwards across the sides of his visor, leaving bare metal scratches in the purple gloss. A third hostile flickered at Tarvitz, but his blood was up. He swung at it, turning his body right around, and cut clean through the midline of the thorax, between upper arms and lower legs. pale liquid spattered into the air, and the top of the alien fell away. The abdomen and the half-thorax remaining, pumping milky fluid, continued to scurry on its four legs for a moment before it collided with a grass stalk and toppled over. And that was the fight done. The storks ceased their shivering, and the wretched grubs started to whistle and buzz again. When they had been on the ground for 90 hours and had engaged with the megarachnid 28 times in the dense thickets of the grass forests, 7 of their meagre party were dead and gone. The process of advance became mechanical, almost trance-like. They had established no contact with the Blood Angels or their lord or any segments of other sections of their company. They moved forwards, and every few kilometres fighting broke out. This was an almost perfect war, Saul Tarvis decided. Simple and engrossing, testing their combat skills and physical prowess to destruction. It was like a training regime made lethal. His instincts had grown as sharp as the enemy limb blades. He was on guard at all times, for the megarachnid ambushes were sudden and ferocious and came out of nowhere. The party moved, then fought without space for rest or reflection. Tarvitz had never known and would never know again such pure martial perfection, utterly uncomplicated by politics or beliefs. He and his fellows were weapons of the Emperor, and the megarachnid were the unqualified quintessence of the hostile cosmos that stood in man's way. Almost all of the gradually dwindling Astartes had switched to their blades. It took too many bolter rounds to bring a megarachnid down. A blade was surer, provided one was quick enough to get the first stroke in, and strong enough to ensure that stroke was a killing blow. It was with some surprise that Tarvitz discovered his fellow captain, Lucius, thought differently. As they pushed on, Lucius boasted that he was playing with the enemy. "It's like dueling with 4 swordsmen at once." Lucius was a bladesman, and to Tarvitz's knowledge had never been bested in swordplay. Lucius carried an antique longsword, a relic of the Unification Wars, forged in the smithies of the Urals by artisans of the Terawat clan. It was a masterpiece of perfect balance and temper. Usually, he fought with it in the old style, with a combat shield locked to his left arm. He had his shield strapped across his back and carried the megarachnid blade limb in his left hand as a secondary sword. He had bound the base of the severed limb with strips of steel paper from the liner of his shield to prevent the edge from further harming his grip. Head low, he paced forward through the endless avenues of stalks, hungry for any opportunity to deal death. During the 12th attack, Tarvitz witnessed Lucius at work for the first time. Lucius met a megarachnid head-on and set up a flurry of dazzling, ringing blows, his 2 blades against the creature's 4. Tarvitz saw 3 opportunities for straight killstrokes that Lucius didn't so much miss as choose not to take. He was enjoying himself so much that he didn't want the game to end too soon. "We will take 1 or 2 alive later," he told Tarvitz after the fight, without a hint of irony. "I will chain them in the practice cages. They will be useful for sparring." "They are Xenos," Tarvitz scolded. Tarvitz was proud that he didn't even begin to understand how Xenos minds worked, but he was also confident that the purpose of the megarachnid, if they had some higher, ineffable purpose, was more than to give mankind a demanding training partner. He wondered, briefly, if they had language or culture, culture as a man might recognize it, or were those things as seamlessly and exotically bonded to them as their technologies, so that mortal men might not differentiate or identify them? Were they driven by some emotive cause to attack the Emperor's children, or were they simply responding to trespass, like a mound of drone insects prodded with a stick? It occurred to him that the megarachnid might be attacking because, to them, the humans were hideous and Xenos. It was a terrible thought. Surely the megarachnid could see the superiority of the human design compared with their own. Maybe they fought because of jealousy. "Here is something," a voice exclaimed over the vox. It was Sakian. They hurried to him. He had found a sudden and surprising clearing in the grass forest. The stalks had stopped, exposing a broad field of bare, red earth many kilometres square. "What is this?" asked Bull. Tarvitz wondered if the space had been deliberately cleared, but there was no sign that stalks had ever sprouted there. The tall, swishing forest surrounded the area on all sides. One by one, the Astartes stepped out into the open. It was unsettling. Moving through the grass forest, there had been precious little sense of going anywhere, because everywhere looked the same. This gap was suddenly a landmark, a disconcerting difference. "Look here!" Sakian called. He was 20 meters out in the barren plain, kneeling to examine something. Tarvitz realized he had called out because of something more specific than the change in environs. "What is it?" Tarvitz asked, trudging forwards to join Sakian. Sakian held an object out so that Tarvitz could inspect it. It was a triangular, vaguely concave piece of tinted glass with rounded corners, roughly 9 centimeters on its longer side. Its edges were lipped and machine-formed. Tarvitz knew what it was at once, because he was staring at it through 2 similar objects. It was a visor lens from an Astartes helmet. What manner of force could have popped it out of its ceramite frame? "The Blood Angels?" Sakian asked. "Yes, the Blood Angels. The first physical proof that anyone had been here before them." "Look around," Tarvitz ordered to the others. "Search the dirt." The troop spent 10 minutes searching. Nothing else was discovered. Overhead, an especially fierce shield storm had begun to close in, as if drawn to them. Furious ripples of lightning striated the heavy clouds. The light grew yellow, and the storm's distortions whined and shrieked intrusively into their vox links. "We're exposed out here," Bull muttered. "Let's get back into the forest." Tarvitz was amused. Bull made it sound as if the stalk thickets were safe ground. Giant forks of lightning, savage and yellow-white phosphorescent, were searing down into the open space, explosively scorching the earth. Though each fork only existed for a nanosecond, they seemed solid and real, like fundamental physical structures, like upturned thorny trees. 3 Astartes, including Lucius, were struck. Secure in their Mark IV plate, they shrugged off the massive detonating impacts and laughed as aftershock electrical blooms crackled like garlands of blue wire around their armour for a few seconds. "Bull's right," Lucius said, his vox signal temporarily mauled by the discharge dissipating from his suit. "I want to go back into the forest. I want to hunt. I haven't killed anything in 20 minutes. Several of the men around roared their approval at Lucius's willfully belligerent pronouncement. They slapped their fists against their shields. Tarvitz had been trying to contact Lord Eidolon again, or anyone else, but the storm was still blocking him. He was concerned that the few of them still remaining should not separate, but Lucius's bravado had annoyed him. "Do as you see fit, Captain. I want to find out what that is," he said to Lucius, petulantly. He pointed. On the far side of the cleared space, 3 or 4 kilometres away, he could make out large white blobs in the far thickets. "More trees?" Lucius said. "Yes, but..." "Oh, very well," Lucius conceded. There were now just 22 warriors in the group, led by Lucius and Tarvitz. They spread out in a loose line and began to cross the open space. The clearing, at least, afforded them time to see any Megarachnid approach. When the Megarachnid appeared, they showed themselves in ones or twos at first. Cat saw them initially and called out. The grey things were milling in and out of the edges of the stalk forest. Then they began to emerge en masse and move across the open ground towards the Astartes war party. There were more than 100 of the aliens. Chittering, they closed on the Astartes from all sides, an accelerating ring of onrushing grey closing faster and faster, a blur of scurrying limbs. "Form a ring," Tarvitz instructed calmly. "Bolters." He stuck his broadsword tip down into the red earth beside him and unslung his firearm. Others did likewise. Tarvitz noticed that Lucius kept his grip on his paired blades. The flood of Megarachnid swallowed up the ground and closed in a concentric ring around the circle of the Emperor's children. "Ready yourselves," Tarvitz called. Lucius, his swords raised by his sides, was evidently happy for Tarvitz to command the action. When the tightening wave of Megarachnid warriors was 10.5 meters away, Bull yelled, "Fire!" And the firm circle of Astartes opened up. Their weapons made a huge rolling noise, despite the storm. All around them, the front ranks of the enemy buckled and toppled, some splintering apart, some bursting. Pieces of thorny, zinc-grey metal spun away into the air. As Bull had instructed, the Astartes fired until their weapons were spent, and then hefted their blades up in time to meet the onrushing foe. The Megarachnid broke around them like a wave around a rock. There was a flurried, multiplied din of metal-on-metal impacts as human and alien blades clashed. The battle lasted for 3 minutes. Its intensity should have been spread out across an hour or two. 5 more Astartes died. Dozens of Megarachnid things fell, broken and rent, onto the red earth. "Regroup! Reload!" Tarvitz heard himself yelling. "Look!" Katz called out. Tarvitz looked. There was something in the sky, objects sweeping down out of the molten, fracturing air above them. The Megarachnid had more than one biological form. The flying things descended on long, glassy wings that beat so furiously they were just flickering blurs that made a strident, thrumming noise. Their bodies were glossy black, their abdomens much fuller and longer than those of their land-bound cousins. Their slender legs were pulled up beneath them like wrought iron undercarriages. The winged clades took men from the air, dropping sharply and seizing armoured forms in the hooked embrace of their dark limbs. Men fought back, struggled, fired their weapons, but within seconds 4 or 5 warriors had been snatched up and borne away into the tumultuous sky, writhing and shouting. Unit cohesion broke. The men scattered, trying to evade the thing swooping out of the air. Tarvitz yelled for order, but knew it was futile. He was forced to duck as a winged shape rushed over him, making a reverberative drone. He caught a glimpse of a headcrest formed into a long, dark, malevolent hook. Another pass close by. Bolt guns were pumping. Tarvitz lashed out with his sword, striking high, trying to drive the creature back. He jabbed and thrust with his blade, and the thing bobbed backwards across the soil. With a sharp, sudden movement, it turned away, took hold of another man, and lifted him into the sky. Another of the winged things had seized Lucius. It had him by the back and was taking him off the ground. Lucius, twisting like a maniac, was trying to stab his swords up behind himself to no avail. Tarvitz sprang forwards and grabbed hold of Lucius as he left the ground. Tarvitz thrust up past him with his broadsword, but a hooked black leg struck him and his broadsword tumbled away out of his hand. He held on to Lucius. "Drop! Drop!" Lucius yelled. Tarvitz could see that the thing held Lucius by the shield strapped to his back. Swinging, he wrenched out his combat knife and hacked at the straps. They sheared away, and Lucius and Tarvitz fell from the thing's clutches, plummeting 10 meters onto the red dust. The flying clades made off, taking 9 of the Astartes with them. They were heading in the direction of the white blobs in the far thickets. Tarvitz didn't need to give an order. The remaining warriors took off across the ground as fast as they could, chasing after the retreating dots. They caught up with them at the far edge of the clearing. The white blobs had indeed been more trees, 3 of them, and now Lucius discovered they had a purpose after all. The bodies of the taken Astartes were impaled upon the thorns of the trees, rammed onto the stone spikes, their armoured shapes skewered into place, allowing the winged Megarachnid to feed upon them. The creatures, their wings now stilled and quiet and extended, long and slender, were crawling over the stone trees, gnawing and biting, using their hooked head crests to break open thorn-pinned armour to get at the meat within. Tarvitz and the others came to a halt and watched in sick dismay. Blood was dripping from the white thorns and streaming down the squat, chalky trunks. Their brothers were not alone amongst the thorns. Other cadavers hung there, rotten and rendered down to bone and dry gristle. Pieces of red armour plate hung from the reduced bodies. At last, they had found out what had happened to the Blood Angels. The fleet had embarked for murder less than a week after the Whisperheads incident. The transmitted requests for assistance had become so insistent that any debate as to what the 63rd Expedition undertook next became academic. The War Master had ordered the immediate departure of 10 companies under his personal command, leaving Varvarus behind with the bulk of the fleet to oversee the general withdrawal from 6319. Once 10th Company had been chosen as part of the relief force, Loken had found himself too occupied with the hectic preparations for transit to let his mind dwell on the incident. It was a relief to be busy. There were squad formations to be reassigned and replacements to be selected from the Legion's novitiate and scout auxiliaries. He had to find men to fill the gaps in Hellbore and Breakspur, and that meant screening young candidates and making decisions that would change lives forever. Who were the best? Who should be given the chance to advance to full Astartes status? Loken had elected to clear out the dormitory cells of the dead men himself. "Vipers and I can do that," Torgadon said. "Don't bother yourself." "I want to do it," Loken replied. "I should do it."
"Let in, Taric," said Axeman. "He's right, he should."
Loken found himself truly warming to little Horus for the first time. He had not imagined they would ever be close, but what had first seemed to be quiet, reserved, and stern in little Horus, Axeman, was proving to be plain-spoken, empathic, and wise. When he came to clean out the cells, Loken made a discovery. Amongst Xavier Jubal's effects, Loken found a small silver medal unmounted on any chain or cord. It was the size of a coin, a wolf's head set against a crescent moon.
"What is this?" Loken asked Nero Vipers, who had come along with him.
"I can't say."
"Nero?"
"It could be a lodge medal," Vipers replied dismissively. He turned the silver medal over in his palm.
"Jubal was a lodge member then, eh?" Loken said.
Officially, there were no warrior lodges within the Adeptus Astartes. It was common knowledge that the Emperor frowned on such institutions, claiming they were dangerously close to cults and only a step away from the imperial creed, the Lectio Divinitatis, that supported the notion of the Emperor as a god. But fraternal lodges did exist within the Astartes, occult and private. According to rumours, they had been active in the 16th Legion for a long time. Some six decades earlier, the Lunar Wolves, in collaboration with the 17th Legion, the Word Bearers, had undertaken the compliance of a world called Davin, a feral place. Davin had been controlled by a remarkable warrior caste whose savage nobility had won the respect of the Astartes sent to pacify their warring feuds. The Davinite warriors had ruled their world through a complex structure of warrior lodges, quasi-religious societies that had venerated various local predators. By cultural osmosis, the lodge practices had been quietly absorbed by the legions. Loken had once asked his mentor, Cinderman, about them. "They're harmless," the iterator had told him. "Warriors always seek the brotherhood of their kind. As I understand it, they seek to promote fellowship across the hierarchies of command, irrespective of rank or position. A kind of internal bond, a ribwork of loyalty that operates, as it were, perpendicular to the official chain of command." Loken had never been sure what something that operated perpendicular to the chain of command might look like, but it sounded wrong to him. Wrong, if nothing else, in that it was deliberately secret and thus deceitful. Wrong in that the Emperor, beloved by all, disapproved of them. "Of course," Cinderman had added, "I can't actually say if they exist." Real or not, Loken had made it plain that any Astartes intending to serve under his captaincy should have nothing to do with them. There had never been any sign that anyone in the Tenth was involved in lodge activities. And now the medal had turned up, a lodge medal, belonging to the man who had turned into a demon and killed his own. Loken was greatly troubled by the discovery. He told Vipers that he wanted it made known that any man in his command who had information concerning the existence of lodges should come forward and speak with him privately if necessary. The next day, when Loken came to sort through the personal effects he had gathered one last time, he found the medal had disappeared. Six weeks into the voyage, while Loken was drilling his new recruits, Axeman came to him. "The Chronicles of Ursh," he muttered. noticing a book Loken had left open beside the training mat.
"I borrowed it from Cinderman," Loken replied.
"I enjoyed it as a child," Axemund replied. "Vulgar, though."
"I think that's why I like it," Loken replied.
"What can I do for you?"
I wanted to speak to you," Axemund said, "on a private matter."
Loken frowned. Axemund opened his hand and revealed a silver lodge medal.
"I would like you to give this a fair hearing," Axemund said, once they had withdrawn to the privacy of Loken's arming chamber, "as a favour to me."
"You know how I feel about lodge activities."
"It's been made known to me. I admire your purity, but there's no hidden malice in the lodge. You have my word, and I hope by now that's worth something."
"It is. Who told you of my interest?"
"I can't say. Garviel, there is a lodge meeting tonight, and I would like you to attend it as my guest. We would like to embrace you to our fraternity."
"I'm not sure I want to be embraced."
"It is simply a band of brothers," Axemund said. "A fraternity of warriors, bipartisan and without rank."
"So I've heard."
"Since the Whisper Heads, we have had a vacancy. We'd like you to fill it."
"A vacancy?" Loken said. "You mean Jubal?"
"Will you come with me?" asked Axemund.
"I will, because it's you who's asking me," said Loken.
Their brothers on the tree were already dead, past saving, but Tarvitz could not leave them skewered and unavenged. The ruination of their proud, perfect forms insulted his eyes and the honour of his legion. He gathered all the explosives carried by the remaining men and moved forwards towards the trees with Bull and Sakian. Lucius stayed with the others. "You're a fool to do that," he told Tarvitz. "We might yet need those charges."
"What for?" Tarvitz asked.
Lucius shrugged. "We've a war to win here."
That almost made Saul Tarvitz laugh.
He wanted to say that they were already dead. Murder had swallowed the companies of blood angels, and now, thanks to Eidolon's zeal for glory, it had swallowed them too. There was no way out. Tarvitz didn't know how many of the company were still alive on the surface, but if the other groups had suffered losses commensurate to their own, the full number could be little higher than 50. 50 men, 50 Astartes even, against a world of numberless hostiles. This was not a war to win. This was just a last stand, wherein, by the Emperor's grace, they might take as many of the foe with them as they could before they fell. He did not say this to Lucius, but only because others were in earshot. Lucius's brand of courage admitted no reality, and if Tarvitz had been plain about their situation, it would have led to an argument. The last thing the men needed now was to see their officers quarrelling. "I'll not suffer those trees to stand," Tarvitz said. With Bull and Sakian, he approached the white stone trees, running low until they were under the shadows of their grim, rigid canopies. The winged megarachnid up among the thorns ignored them. They could hear the cracking, clicking noises of the insects feeding, and occasional trickles of black blood spattered down around them. They divided the charges into three equal amounts and secured them to the boles of the trees. Bull set a 40-second timer. They began to run backwards, towards the edge of the stalk forest where Lucius and the rest of the troop lay in cover. "Move it, Saul! Hurry! Don't look back!" Lucius's voice crackled over the vox. Still running, Tarvitz looked behind him. Two of the winged clades had disengaged themselves from the feeding group and had taken to the air. Their beating wings were glass blurs in the yellow light, and the lightning flash glinted off their polished black bodies. They circled up away from the thorn trees and came on in the direction of the three figures, wings throcking the air like the buzz of a gnat, slowed and amplified to gargantuan bass volumes. "Run," said Tarvitz. Sakian glanced back. He lost his footing and fell. Tarvitz skidded to a halt and turned back, dragging Sakian to his feet. Bull had run on. 12 seconds, he yelled, turning and drawing his bolter. He kept backing away, but trained his weapon on the oncoming forms. "Come on," he yelled. Then he started to fire and shouted, "Drop!" Sakian pushed them both down, and he and Tarvitz sprawled onto the red dirt as the first winged clade went over them, so low the downdraft of its whirring wings raised dust. It rose past them and headed straight for Bull, but veered away as he struck it twice with bolter rounds. Tarvitz looked up and saw the second megarachnid drop straight towards him in a near stall, the kind of pounce dive that had snared so many of his comrades earlier. He tried to roll aside. The black thing filled the entire sky. A bolter roared. Sakian had cleared his weapon and was firing upwards, point blank. The shots tore through the winged clade's thorax in a violent puff of smoke and kiting shards, and the thing fell, crushing them both beneath its weight. It twitched and spasmed on top of them, and Tarvitz heard Sakian cry out in pain. Tarvitz scrabbled to heave it away, his hands sticky with its ichor. The charges went off. The shockwave of flame rushed out across the red dirt in all directions. It scorched and demolished the nearby edge of the stalk forest and lifted Tarvitz, Sakian, and the thing pinning them into the air. It blew Bull off its feet, throwing him backwards. It caught the flying thing, tore off its wings, and hurled it into the thickets. The blast leveled the three stone trees. They collapsed like demolished towers, fracturing into brittle splinters and white dust as they fell into the fireball. Two or three of the winged clades feeding on the trees took off, but they were on fire, and the heat suck of the explosion tumbled them back into the flames. Tarvitz got up. The trees had been reduced to a heap of white slag burning furiously. A thick pall of ash-white dust and smoke rolled off the blast zone. Smouldering scads, like volcanic outthrow, drizzled down over him. He hauled Sakian upright. The creature's impact on them had broken Sakian's right arm, and that break had been made worse when they had been thrown by the blast. Sakian was unsteady, but his gen-hanced metabolism was already compensating. Bull, unhurt, was getting up by himself. The vox stirred. It was Lucius. "Happy now?" he asked. Beyond revenge and honour, Tarvitz's actions had two unexpected consequences. The second did not become evident for some time, but the first was apparent in less than 30 minutes. Where the vox had failed to link the scattered forces on the surface, the blast succeeded. Two other troops, one commanded by Captain Antaeus, the other by Lord Eidolon himself, detected the considerable detonation and followed the smoke plume to its source. United, they had almost 50 Astartes between them. "Make report to me," Eidolon said. They had taken up position at the edge of the clearing, some half a kilometre from the destroyed trees near the hem of the stalk forest. The open ground afforded them ample warning of the approach of the megarachnid scurrioclades, and if the winged forms reappeared, they could retreat swiftly into the cover of the thickets and mount a defence. Tarvitz outlined all that had befallen his troops since landfall as quickly and clearly as possible. Lord Eidolon was one of the Primarch's most senior commanders, the first chosen to such a role, and brooked no familiarity, even from senior-line officers like Tarvitz. Saul could tell from his manner that Eidolon was seething with anger. The undertaking had not gone at all to his liking. Tarvitz wondered if Eidolon might ever admit he was wrong to have ordered the drop. He doubted it. Eidolon, like all the elite hierarchy of the Emperor's children, somehow made pride a virtue. "Repeat what you said about the trees," Eidolon prompted. "The winged forms use them to secure prey for feeding, Lord," Tarvitz said. "I understand that," Eidolon snapped. "I've lost men to the winged things, and I've seen the thorn trees, but you say there were other bodies." "The corpses of blood angels, Lord," Tarvitz nodded, "and men of the Imperial Army Force, too." "Have you proof?" Eidolon asked. "I destroyed the trees, as you know, sir," Tarvitz said. "You used all your charges." "Yes, Lord. A waste!" Tarvitz began to reply, but stifled the words before he could say them. If it hadn't been for his use of the explosives, they wouldn't have reunited. If it hadn't been for his use of the explosives, the ragged corpses of fine Emperor's children would have hung from stone gibbets in ignominious disarray. "I told him so, Lord," Lucius remarked. "Told him what?" "That using all our charges was a waste." "What's that in your hand, Captain?" Eidolon asked. Lucius held up the limb blade. "Throw it away, Captain," Eidolon said. "I'm surprised at you using an enemy's claw like a sword." "Yes, Lord." "Tarvitz."
"Yes, my Lord."
"The Blood Angels will require some proof of their fallen, some relic they can honour. You say shreds of armour hung from those trees. Go and retrieve some. Lucius can help you." "My lord, should we not secure this?" "I gave you an order, Captain. Execute it, please. Or does the honour of our brethren legion mean nothing to you?" "I only thought to—" "Did I ask for your counsel? Are you a lord commander and privy to the higher links of command?"
"No, lord."
"Then get to it, Captain. You too, Lucius. You men, assist them." The local shield storm had blown out. The sky over the wide clearing was surprisingly clear and pale, as if night was finally falling. Tarvitz had no idea of Murder's diurnal cycle. Since they had made planetfall, night and day periods must surely have passed, but in the stalk forests, lit by the storm flare, such changes had been imperceptible. Now it seemed cooler, stiller. The sky was a washed-out beige, with filaments of darkness threading through it. There was no wind, and the flicker of sheet lightning came from many kilometres away. Tarvitz thought he could even glimpse stars up there, in the darker patches of the open sky. He led his party out to the ruins of the trees. Lucius was grumbling, as if it was all Tarvitz's fault. "Shut up," Tarvitz told him on a closed channel. "Consider this ample payback for your kiss-ass display to the Lord Commander." "What are you talking about?" Lucius asked. "I told him it was a waste, Lord," Tarvitz answered, mimicking Lucius's words in an unflattering voice. "I did tell you." "Yes, you did. But there's such a thing as solidarity. I thought we were friends." "We are friends," Lucius said, hurt. And that was the act of a friend. "We're the Emperor's children," Lucius said solemnly. "We seek perfection. We don't hide our mistakes. You made a mistake. Acknowledging our failures is another step on the road to perfection. Isn't that what our Primarch teaches?" Tarvitz frowned. Lucius was right. Primarch Fulgrim taught that only by imperfection could they fail the Emperor, and only by recognizing those failures could they eradicate them. Tarvitz wished someone would remind Eidolon of that key tenet of their Legion's philosophy. "I made a mistake," Lucius admitted. "I used that blade thing. I relished it. It was Xenos. Lord Eidolon was right to reprimand me." "I told you it was Xenos." "Yes, you did. I owe you an apology for that. You were right. Saul, I'm sorry." "Never mind." Lucius put his hand on Tarvitz's plated arm and stopped him. "No, it's not. I'm a fine one to talk. You are always so grounded, Saul. I know I mock you for that. I'm sorry. I hope we're still friends." "Of course. Your steadfast manner is a true virtue," Lucius said. "I become obsessive sometimes. It's an imperfection of my character. Perhaps you can help me overcome it. Perhaps I can learn from you." His voice had that childlike tone in it that had made Tarvitz like him in the first place. "And besides," Lucius added, "you saved my life. I haven't thanked you for that."
"No, you haven't, but there's no need, brother."
"Then let's get this done, eh?"
The other men had waited while Tarvitz and Lucius conducted their private vox-to-vox conversation. The pair hurried over to rejoin them. The men Eidolon had picked to go with them were Bull, Ferost, Lodoroton, and Tychus, all men from Tarvitz's squad. Eidolon was so clearly punishing the troop, it wasn't funny. Tarvitz hated the fact that his men suffered because he was not in favour. And Tarvitz had a feeling they weren't being punished for wasting charges. They were suffering Eidolon's opprobrium because they had achieved more of significance than either of the other groups since the drop. They reached the ruined trees and crunched up the slopes of smouldering white slag. Remnants of stone thorns stuck out of the heap like the antlers of bull deer, some blackened with charred scraps of flesh.
"What do we do?" asked Tychus.
Tarvitz sighed and knelt down in the white spoil. He began to sift aside the chalky debris with his gloved hands. "This," he said. They worked for an hour or two. Some kind of night began to fall, and the air temperature dropped sharply as the light drained out of the sky. Stars came out, properly, and distant lightning played across the endless grass forest, ringing the clearing. Immense heat was issuing from the heart of the slag heap, and it made the cold air around them shimmer. They sifted the dusty slag piece by piece and retrieved two battered shoulder plates, both Blood Angel's issue, and an Imperial Army cap.
"Is that enough?" asked Lodoroton.
"Keep going," replied Tarvitz. He looked out across the dim clearing to where Eidolon's force was dug in. "Another hour, maybe, and we'll stop." Lucius found a Blood Angel's helmet. Part of the skull was still inside it. Tychus found a breastplate belonging to one of the lost Emperor's children. "Bring that too," Tarvitz said.
"Do you hear that?"
asked Lucius. It had become
very still and dark, like a true and proper nightfall. Amping their helmet acoustics, they could all hear the chittering noise Lucius had detected. In the edges of the thickets, starlight flashed off busy metallic forms.
"They're back," said Lucius, looking round at Tarvitz.
"Tarvitz to main party," Tarvitz foxed. "Hostile contact in the edges of the forest."
"We see it, Captain," Eidolon responded immediately. "Hold your position until we..."
The link cut off abruptly, like it was being jammed.
"We should go back," Lucius said.
"Yes," Tarvitz agreed.
A sudden light and noise made them all start. The main party, half a kilometre away, had opened fire. Across the distance, they heard and saw bolters drumming and flashing in the darkness. Distant, zinc-grey forms danced and jittered in the strobing light of the gunfire. Eidolon's position had been attacked.
"Come on," Lucius cried.
"And do what?" Tarvitz asked.
"Wait! Look!"
The six of them scrambled down into cover on one side of the spoil heap. Megarachnid were approaching from the edges of the forest, their marching grey forms almost invisible, except where they caught the starlight and the distant blink of lightning. They were streaming towards the tree mound in their hundreds, in neat, ordered lines. Amongst them, there were other shapes, bigger shapes, massive Megarachnid forms, another clade variant. Tarvitz's party slid down the chalky rubble and backed away into the open, the expanse of the clearing behind them keeping low. To their right, Lord Eidolon's position was engulfed in loud, furious combat.
"What are they doing?" asked Bull.
"Look!" said Tarvitz. The columns of Megarachnid ascended the heap of rubble. Warrior forms equipped with quad blades took station around the base on guard. Others mounted the slopes and began to sort the spoil, clearing it with inhuman speed and efficiency. Tarvitz saw warrior forms doing this work, and also clades of a similar design, but which possessed spatulate shovel limbs in place of blades. With minute precision, the Megarachnid began to disassemble the rubble heap and carry the loose debris away into the thickets. They formed long mechanical work gangs to do this. The more massive forms the clades Tarvitz had not seen before came forwards. They were super-heavy monsters with short, thick legs and gigantic abdomens. They moved ponderously and began to gnaw and suck on the loose rubble with ghastly, oversized mouthparts. The smaller clades scurried round their hefty forms, pulling skeins of white matter from their abdominal spinnerets with curiously dainty weaving motions of their upper limbs. The smaller clades carried this fibrous, stiffening matter back into the increasingly cleared site and began to plaster it together.
"They're rebuilding the trees," Bull whispered.
It was an extraordinary sight. The massive clades, weavers, were consuming the broken scraps of the trees Tarvis had felled and turning them into fresh new material. The smaller clades, busy and scurrying, were taking the material and forming new bases with it in the space that others of their kind had cleared. In less than 10 minutes, much of the area had been picked clean, and the trunks of three new trees were being formed. The scurrying builders brought limb loads of wet, milk-white matter to the bases, and then regurgitated fluid onto them so as to mix them as cement. Their limbs whirred and shaped like the trowels of master builders. Still the battle behind them roared. Lucius kept glancing in the direction of the fight.
"We should go back," he whispered. "Lord Eidolon needs us."
"If he can't win without the six of us," Tarvitz said, "he can't win. I felled these trees. I'll not see them built again.
Who's with me?"
Bull answered, "Aye. So did Ferost, Lodoraton, and Tychus."
"Very well," said Lucius. "What do we do?"
The fight that followed was simple insanity. The six Astartes, blades out, bolters ready, rushed the Megarachnid work gangs and made war upon them in the cold night air. Picket clades, warrior forms, drawn up as sentinels around the edge of the site, alerted to them first and rushed out in defence. Lucius and Bull met them and slaughtered them, and Tarvitz and Tychus ploughed on into the main site to confront the industrious builder forms. Ferost and Lodoraton followed them, firing wide to fend off flank strikes. Tarvitz attacked one of the monster weaver forms, one of the builder clades, and split its massive belly wide open with his sword. Molten cement poured out like pus, and it began to claw at the sky with its short, heavy limbs. Warrior forms leapt over its stricken mass to attack the Imperials. Tychus shot two out of the air and then decapitated a third as it pounced on him. The Megarachnid were everywhere, milling like ants. Lodderaton had slain eight of them, including another monster clade, when a warrior form bit off his head. As if unsatisfied with that, the warrior form proceeded to flense Lodderaton's body apart with its four limb blades. Blood and meat particles spumed into the cold air. Bull shot the warrior clade dead with a single bolt round. It dropped on its face. Lucius hacked his way through the outer guards, which were closing on him in ever-increasing numbers. He swung his sword, no longer playing, no longer toying. This was test enough. He'd killed 16 Megarachnid by the time they got him. A clade with spatulate limbs bearing a cargo of wet, milky cement fell apart under his sword strokes and, dying, dumped its payload on him. Lucius fell, his arms and legs glued together by the wet load. He tried to break free, but the organic mulch began to thicken and solidify. A warrior clade pounced on him and made to skewer him with its four-blade arms. Tarvitz shot it in the side of the body and knocked it away. He stood over Lucius to protect him from the Xenos scum. Bull came to his side, shooting and chopping. Ferrest fought his way to join them, but fell as a limb blade punched clean through his torso from behind. Tychus backed up close. The three remaining Emperor's children blazed and sliced away at the enclosing foe. At their feet, Lucius struggled to free himself and get up. "Get this off me, Saul!" he yelled. Tarvitz wanted to. He wanted to be able to turn and hack free his stricken friend, but there was no space, no time. The Megarachnid warrior clades were all over them now, chittering and slashing. If he broke off, even for a moment, he would be dead. Thunder boomed in the clear night sky. Caught up in the fierce warfare, Tarvitz paid it no heed, just the shield storm returning. But it wasn't. Meteors were dropping out of the sky into the clearing around them, impacting hard and super hot in the red dirt, like lightning strikes. 2, 4, 12, 20. Drop pods. The noise of fresh fire rang out above the din of the fight. Bolters boomed, plasma weapons shrieked, the drop pods kept falling like bombs. "Look!" Bull cried out. "Look!" The Megarachnid were swarming over them. Tarvitz had lost his bolter and could barely swing his broadsword. Such was the density of enemies upon him. He felt himself slowly being borne over by sheer weight of numbers. An explosion, a series of rapid gunshots, a shock wave rocked through the enemy masses. "Follow me in!" a voice was yelling, commanding and deep. "Follow me in and drive them back!" More searing explosions. Grey bodies blew apart in gouts of flame, spinning broken limbs into the air like matchwood. One whizzing limb smacked into Tarvitz's visor and knocked him onto his back. The world, scarlet and concussed, spun for a second. A hand reached down towards Tarvitz. It swam into his field of view. It was an Astartes gauntlet, white with black edging. "Up you come, brother!" Tarvitz grabbed at it and felt himself hauled upright. "My thanks," he yelled, mayhem still raging all around him. "Who are you?" "My name is Tarik, brother," said his saviour. "Pleased to meet you."